Siren Radio.
Excellent. Jason, I am looking at some audaciously wonderful news which actually deals with crowdfunding and an amazing story and tale of how William Blake has successfully managed to secure, well, not for himself, obviously, with a certain amount of assistance, a new brand spanking tombstone.
Absolutely. So after 191 years, they've finally worked out where the bugger's buried and have marked the spot with a beautiful new tombstone. Which I was there at the unveiling on Sunday.
I was going to say £30,000, so no scrimping in the sense from that point of view.
Not.
And it's really great to see that it was raised via crowdfunding, because you often think, that's how we pass the day with respect to crowdfunding. But it's,
No, and one of the things that was very clear from the event on Sunday is the number of people that turned up, just how popular Blake is. Hmm. So the organisers were expecting, you know, somewhere between 50 and 100, and the estimates were 500 to 800 people in Bunhill Fields in London, where Blake is buried.
Well, Anna, you clearly have to get on the case as somebody who's been checking out various headstones and so on. Anna Lewis, you clearly need to find this tombstone and confirm that it's still in top quality condition.
Yes, I think gravestones are so important in our sort of social history, because it tells us a lot about not just the person who died and all the blurb that's written on it, but also about the people that decided to put it there in the first place. And there's a tombstone that I went in hunt of a chap called William Kennedy Laurie Dixon, who was the sort of inventor of the kinetoscope with Edison. And unfortunately, fortunately for Edison, he did really, really well, and Mr. Laurie Dixon didn't do so well, and his tombstone is extremely modest and in a terrible condition in Twickenham Cemetery. And I'm trying to find ways with a gentleman who's interested in this of having his tombstone redone. Nowhere near as old as Blake's, and obviously Blake's wasn't there at all. From what I understand, he was in an unmarked grave.
He was in an unmarked grave, and you say about the social history, he was actually in a grave with 8 other people.
Oh,
literally, there were 3 beneath him and 4 above, so that, which was really common practice.
I mean, I know, I've read that there were tape measures involved in actually locating the grave.
Yes.
But how difficult a task do you think it was for the people involved in that search? Because it must have been quite a tricky exercise in terms of measurement.
Well, it was and it wasn't when the missing piece of information was found, which was a book, I think, dating from the 1780s, which actually kept a record of all the burials in Bunhill Fields. And they were marked in Cartesian coordinates, so you literally could find it by just marking off the feet from each end of the cemetery.
Wow, that's quite impressive. I'm glad those records still exist.
Well, they've gone missing for, you know, a couple of hundred years, which was...
But they've turned
their discovery
up now.
Yeah, the discovery was what allowed people to find his grave.
Good. That's really lucky.
I give you the end of a golden string, only wind it into a ball. It will lead you in at Heaven's Gate, built...
in Jerusalem's wall, which is taken from Jerusalem, the emanation of the giant Albion.
And that's just one of the amazing pieces of information you can find from the William Blake series of podcasts that, in fact, Jason, you've been busily producing as well.
I am starting to record, yes, a series of podcasts on William Blake, The Man and the Music, yes.
You see, it almost makes the 21st century just that little bit more bearable, doesn't it, Anna, when you realise that it's being used to kind of connect with various other things and so on. So, Anna, we had thought we'd be connecting with you in Brighton, but obviously you decided, no, we're going to stay in London for the day. What other things have you been getting up to?
Well, yesterday was quite an interesting day. My daughter and I ventured into central London. We went to the Foundling Museum in Coram Fields. Mr. Thomas Coram was a great sort of 18th century benefactor. Having no children himself, devoted himself to opening his doors for children to be dropped off at what was known as the Foundling Hospital, just off Russell Square. And they do amazing work, but it's also interesting to see the people that were involved. And one of them was the composer Handel, who has his own floor. The second floor of the museum is dedicated to Handel and his music, and they have his will there. And obviously he was very concerned about the welfare of children, literally dropped off at the gates of the Foundling Hospital. So it was an emotional day as well, actually, because you suddenly realise that, these things still go on. You know, children do turn up. And even in Jersey, just before I left it, back in March last year, a baby was left at the door of the local hospital, in fact, the A&E department, and they, to my knowledge, have not found the mother of this child that was dropped off there. So, yeah, it's poignant stuff.
And, of course, Mr. Rees-Mogg would like to take us back to those days so they become a matter of course, really, which is all fun, you know, in all sorts of ways. Sorry, Heather, there's a good point. I'll ease away. It is after all these silly seasons, so we'll step away from political points and various other factors as well. Anna, it's been awesome connecting with your good self, and I'm sure... Will you be in Brighton next week, or are you postponing that for a while?
Postponing it. My friend's not very well. We were going to go and see the pavilion together, so we had a good plan of action, but obviously... When you're not feeling up to it, you don't.
Brighton is not a place to enjoy. In fact, we've got a couple of Brighton people coming up in a couple of weeks' time. My first-class honours music graduate who's coming up with Rosie Langhorne, who Jason was actually one of my first ever interviewees when she was with a group called Legs & Co, who used to dance on Top of Pops back in the day. Yes. I know, it's a strange and bizarre and somewhat surreal world, but I'm trying to persuade her to do her postgraduate stuff here. Her daughter, that is, but anyway, more to come as far as that's actually concerned. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today, Anna Lewis?
I certainly have, thank you.
And I take it you'll be back again next week?
Would love to. Thank you very much.
Of an accidental hipster, not from the 60s, but from Monkees 2 years ago, and their newest album anyway, is just after Davy Jones had moved into the great studio in the sky. But now we utter those words, punk rock and oral history. Well, it's needed to be said, it will be talked about, and we're delighted now to be able to welcome the author of Punk Rock and Oral History. It's John Robb. How are you, John?
I'm okay. How are you? Okay.
We're okay, you're okay. This has got to be a series in that, in some way, shape, or form. I shall introduce you to Professor Jason Whittaker.
Hello.
Jason,
hello,
I know you like your anarchy. I appreciate the anarchy.
Only in the UK, though.
Yeah, exactly. What about the punk music scene? Because, like myself, you're probably around when punk was emerging, really.
I was. Strictly speaking, I was too young for punk itself, but I really came of age during the post-punk scene, which, so, sort of from Joy Division onwards, this defined my musical consumption.
So, John, would you like to share with us why you started developing this particular interest and why you're also going to be able to chat to people and meet folk in full force at the Lincoln Book Festival this year?
Well, I guess for me, Paul, because I'm probably slightly older, so for me when I was 15, 16, when it started, it was just a perfect reflection of what you felt like, what you wanted to listen to. The whole thing, just like, you were already there, I think, and the music just escapulated that and coloured it all in. It was a really fantastic time. But I like the post-punk era as well, but it wasn't actually called post-punk at the time. It just felt like a good situation for punk, really. So for the book, well, that was just like years later. I just had an idea to do a history on it. And I knew all the people anyway, just playing gigs and festivals, so it wasn't that hard to put together, because just when you throw the people you kind of knew. It really in-depth interviews, trying to tell the story, not to widen the story out, because the story's been very narrowed down over the years, you know, just this very familiar staging pose. But the story of punk, I think, is more interesting than that. It's a wider story, you know, bands that are less fashionable or equally important than the whole story.
There were, of course, an awful lot of bands who would claim that they weren't punk, the Stranglers being somebody who was lumped in with the punk banner. I mean, how would you define the punk rock movement? Was it just a rebellion against what was perceived as the establishment, the overblown bands of the time, dare I say it, the Supertramps, the Electric Light Orchestras, and so on?
I think one of the great truisms is that anybody that tried to define punk out of the conversation straight away. Because it's an indefinable, really. Everyone also has their own personal kind of idea of what it is. So whatever you say it is, about another 100,000 people have the opposite view, which I think that's absolutely fantastic, really, because I think, unlike, say, mod culture, which is, you know, this is not critique of mod culture, which is, it's a very defined idea of what it is and what records it is and what clothes it is and what period it covers. Punk was just like a constant argument, a constantly evolving argument where nobody could agree on anything. And I think that's a perfect way to have any kind of culture.
A constant argument where nobody can agree on anything. Jason?
I was thinking just how perfect that is, actually. I mean, one thing that always struck me was that massive difference between American punk, which sort of seemed completely and utterly different from anything that was happening in the UK at the time.
Yeah, so, that's true, and it was far more comic book and more bubblegum.
Yeah.
And
But still great stuff.
Yeah, it was great scene, but when you look at a band of their own who made great songs, they weren't really a punk band in a sense, they were more like a pop band. They kind of got caught up in this whole thing, which they didn't really understand, because the British version was really different. The British version had a lot of like British kind of ideas in it as well. It was more about the clothes, it was more about, there had to be a manifesto, whether you believed in it or not, you know, so each group would have its own separate manifesto. And also, in the weird ways, deeply traditional, deeply almost showbiz. One, if you look at the Clash and the Pistols, having a manager who kind of defined what they did and what they were. That's like Larry Palms in the 50s.
Yeah.
Now when I look back on it, it's at the time it felt like this complete rip in the fabric of culture. And now you look back on it, it just seems like a continuation of what went before. Is it massively different from the glam rock scene? Is it, you know, it felt like it was at the time, but now it just feels like a blur of 70s culture.
John, we have you down as journalist, author, singer, songwriter, TV pundit. You've compared Justice Tonight in aid of the Hillsborough Justice Campaign. Tragically, we haven't got any of the Membranes material for you, good self. But when you set up the Membranes, according to the wonderful survey of the web and so on, there's a claim that you were inspired by the DIY ethic of punk. Was that a case of that we can actually do the song right here, that just like Lonnie Donegan did back in the 50s with his chewing gum on his bedpost, you can do the same with punk as well?
Well, actually, Lonnie Donegan is an interesting example, because everyone knows him for the novelty hits, but he was actually like pure raw rock and roll and inspired a lot of people just to make music themselves, in a way. You could argue he isn't antecedent of punk. For us, we're more in the post-punk period, but we were inspired by that DIY effort of punk. So anybody could do it. You didn't need anybody's permission to create art. You know, there's as soon as it's like, you know, like an X Factor, where there's like an older person telling a young person how to make art and giving them permission to perform, it's all wrong for me. That's not how you... Well, of course, I would think that could come from a different kind of time zone. Mm. But we came from a place where you made the art, whether people liked it or not, was inconsequential. You weren't thinking, if you write the song this way, loads of people are going to like it. That was not important. We were inspired in the north of England. I was growing up in Blackpool by Buzzcocks when that Spiral Scratch EP came out in January 77. Somebody brought it to school, and the homemade nature of it was inspiring. So never realised you make your own records. It took us 2 years to work out how to do it. But it's like this idea that you could actually, you know, if you make your own record, and it sounded photocopied as well, which is great. You know, the actual rawness of the music, it sounded really homemade. Like, anybody can make it. I mean, a lot of the original punk bands, the 77 punk bands, like Pistols, Clash, Stranglers, wherever you place them, they're actually very musical. They're very hard to copy, you know. The music is difficult to play. But Buzzcocks is simpler. But if you take away Pete Shelley's genius and melody and things, so there was an open door. It's like anybody could go in. I think in the end, that was a revolutionary statement in that music, that anybody can make art.
Is that something, do you think, William Blake would have endorsed?
William Blake, there's a punk Blake. the number of people who are kind of into punk or very new wave, you know, successors to punk, who are into Blake, because the comment you made about DIY culture, Blake had a great quote, "I must create a system or be enslaved by another man's." And that's just, you know, Dada, various art movements.
Quintessential punk.
Absolutely. You've got to do it yourself.
He got arrested for slagging off.
He did in 1803, yeah.
Yeah. He's ticking a lot of boxes here.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've been to the pub where he got arrested in Bognor Regis, like a little plaque on the wall.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, punk, on one level, it's very rudimentary, but on another level, the music was the same kind of fantastic visions that Blake was having. You know, it's like a way of making amazing, mind-blowing art in a very rudimentary way. Yeah. Fascinating. Also something that's quite British, I think.
Yes.
I think, that's a little different to American bands. They're much more musical, weren't they? They're older as well, I think, when you actually look at them. They're 24, 25, yeah, which is older at the time. Yeah. And they're like, more accomplished. Yeah. I mean, comparatively, because the British bands of 18, 19, 20, that's quite a big gap, that stage of your life. And they were just trying to make amazing music with barely any idea of how to do it, but somehow they did, and I've always found that quite fascinating as well.
John, what can people expect when you come in under the guise of Anarchy on Friday in September for the Lincoln Book Festival?
I think it's just a free-form flow of ideas. I mean, I don't think you should ever have a plan, should you? You just go in a room and just do stuff, don't you? It's kind of like almost like free jazz talking, isn't it? It's kind of very punk rock as well. I don't think anything should have hit bullet points of what we're going to cover. Well, I mean, we could cover anything, we will.
Even Blackpool Football Club?
Well, there's a club, isn't it? There's a club that actually completely mirrors everything's wrong in the world these days. It's a club run by a senile old dictator who won't listen to the people. I mean, if there's ever a mirror reflection of the UK or America, we got like, they call Boris Johnson the pound shot Trump. We got the penny Trump.
So I take it, John, you won't be having Owen Oyston guesting on the lecture. Never mind. It's just a thought. It's just a thought there. John, it's been fabulous touching base with yourself. A couple of final things to ask you. First of all, would you prefer from the Buzzcocks over Everybody's Happy Nowadays or Ever Fall in Love with Someone You Shouldn't Have Fallen in Love with?
Everybody's Happy Nowadays. One, because it's not heard as much.
Mm-hmm.
And two, because it's actually fantastic. It's almost like a neurotic piece of pop music. It's a brilliant melody, but it's so claustrophobic and intense. It's fantastic. There's a word that you describe things towards. People say, what do you think of such stuff? You go, it's great, it's intense. And everything is described like a level of intensity, which kind of tells you something about the time, doesn't it?
Well, John, it's been intense connecting with your good self today. I know we were a bit worried as to whether we'd get through various answer phones and so on and so forth. But have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme yourself? Has it been okay for you, sir?
Oh, yes.
This is good. And will you return?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, yay! Yeah, you know where to find me. Yeah.
By the way, where are you now? Are you walking along the Blackpool Pier?
No, I've lived in Manchester for the last 30-odd years and just walking along Manchester in the rain.
Well, what a beautiful way to actually celebrate and epitomise the entire spirit. John, we salute you. Take care now.
OK, thank you.
Are you happy nowadays, William Coles?
Yes, I am. I'm good. Very happy to be in Scotland.
There we are, you see. Happiness personified. We've just been speaking to wonderful punk artist John Robb. In the studio we have Professor Jason Whittaker. Yay, Jason! Sorry, that was
the only time that happens in
so?
My life.
I don't know. I think staff meetings could be enhanced tremendously if we could actually have some jingles that I could play at judicious times during the actual thing itself.
It starts to feel a bit North Korean.
You think so?
Yeah.
Oh, well, fair enough. William, would you like to quiz Jason on Guardian Masterclass, a new chapter in Masters Education launched with the University of Lincoln, which involves, strangely enough, the Guardian newspaper? Over to you, William.
Yes, I'd love to know about the Guardian Masterclass. They charge a bit, don't they?
Sum
it up briefly for me, please, Professor Jason.
So, from October, we are launching a new MA in Creative Writing and Publishing, half of which will be delivered in the Guardian offices in London with various journalists and writers attached to the Guardian newspaper. The other half of which will be delivered here in Lincoln with myself, various other members of staff from the School of English and Journalism, as well as visiting professors such as Carol Ann Duffy. The course itself will concentrate on areas such as fiction writing, non-fiction and journalism, and also building a profile to expand your career into the publishing industry. And students, as is typical on a master's programme, will end their degree by producing a long, extended piece of work, a creative project of about 15,000 words, which will contribute towards the portfolio with which they will then begin to approach publishers, agents and various other artists.
Very good. So what is going to be your top tip for these aspiring writers and journalists? What, you know, What's the number one thing you're going to be telling them?
Well, the top tip, I think that actually will be really important to this course. Well, it will spend a fair bit of time concentrating on some of the business of publishing. So one of the advantages of hooking up with The Guardian is that some of the sessions will then actually be effectively career fairs running with publishers, with agents in London, in terms then of actually the kind of the top level pitches for people getting their material into print. And the aim then is that over the summer they can work with editors, with various people in the industry to knock their projects into shape.
So, and what's been your biggest success story then?
Well, the biggest success story is getting the degree off the ground. I mean, it will be...
William, we don't have a time machine. You know, go forward a few years and you'll find success stories.
Absolutely.
But a lot of, you know, but just bowling into the whole thing.
It's going to be so the first cohort will be coming in October.
Michael Harris, Michael Harris, director at Guardian Live, has said, "This exciting new partnership offers the combined expertise of Lincoln's academic body with The Guardian's acclaimed masterclasses programme."
Fantastic. But you've done stuff like this before, Professor Jason.
I mean, I've been responsible for being involved in creative writing programs for getting on for 13, 14 years now. And indeed...
A decade and a half.
That you've had.
So, let's see, who the starts at? We've had a number... I mean, actually, because I've also been involved in journalism... I've been putting the spot down trying to remember names at the end of a busy day.
Part of the job head of English and journalism.
I'm trying to remember his name. He's on Radio 4 all the bloody time now. So, sorry, I'll come back to me because I literally cannot remember names at the moment.
Why would we mention that other station in any case? Let's face it, they're only doing something at PM now. I mean, at the end of the day...
Hugh Pym.
We knew we'd get there in the end. Don't worry, Hugh. You can always catch up via podcast on either station, Siren Radio or PM. Once again, I feel as though we've just opened up a whole new range of things. William, what have you been doing now you've been back in Edinburgh? Have you been checking out the festival? And is it something which appeals? Are there any sort of areas which you'd say, yeah, we should check this out? Or is it just a case of, no, I can't stand all that shenanigans and artistic stuff?
I love it. I've only just been back a couple of days. I've seen my brother-in-law, Richard Lloyd Parry, who's been at the book festival plugging his... book on the tsunami in Japan, Ghosts of the Tsunami it's called, and my job really was to go along there and ask him the nastiest question I could think of. And
is that, has he had a reasonably interesting time, or is he coming back again? Sorry, I couldn't resist it.
No, that is not a nasty question. That's a very nice question. That's a nice easy ball, but I spent ages mulling over, then had a word with another hack, and eventually we got a nasty question for him, which boiled down to, what is the most manipulative thing you've done to get a story? He didn't like it, had him squirming.
That's one for the Richard Keebles and the ethics people of the world, I can tell you. Anyway, incidentally, let's turn it on yourself. What's been the most questionable thing that you've come out with in terms of your journalistic career when you were working with News International, please, William? Okay, then. Fair enough. I think that says it all. says it all, really. We'll talk of
that. I'll tell you one thing I did. I don't mind telling you this one. This was about 23 years ago. I put on my best suit, and I went down to Eton, to the school photographers, Hills and Saunders, and I pretended to be the uncle of a boy in Prince William's house, and I got hold of Prince William's house picture for 13 quid.
Whoa, there we are. That's Secret Service writ large. William, I mean, we salute you in a sense, but on the other hand, obviously, we frown at the abuse of power that you were sort of putting into place there. Still, it's the freedom of the press and, to a certain extent, in the public interest as well.
The school photographers did very well out of it. They got, they fired in an invoice to the Sun for 27 grand, and it was paid immediately.
Splendid. Yes, it's a win-win situation then. It's what we like to hear. And we also have to say, have you had a reasonably interesting, albeit brief, telephonic link with us on the programme today, William Coles?
Yes, I have. Thank you so much for asking.
And will you be back with us next week?
as soon as you ask me. Yes,
you may notice next week there is a big reveal, because if you've been following social media with David Fox Magic, you will find that an envelope was posted to me today, which I took receipt of and have duly put away to one side. I mustn't open it until next week, but it involves predictions. So you may well be involved with respect to how accurate these predictions are, whatever they may be. It's exciting,
right,
isn't it?
Right, OK. I look forward to it.
Meanwhile, from the rhetorical question world... And I sincerely hope that we will hear Does This Train Stop on Merseyside live at the Bluebell Hotel at the Marketplace in Belford this coming Saturday. Will we not, Ian Prowse?
I imagine it'll be part of the set.
Oh.
Excellent. Ian, welcome back to the Midweek Drive. Good to connect with you as ever. And, it's the first ever Bluebella Festival. First ever Bluebella. And it's taking place at the Bluebell in Belford, a place that I've passed through in times past, but have never actually spent much time in on my way to Alnwick or indeed any of those other Northumbria parts of the world. But looking forward to seeing this on 2 p.m. It's a good lineup. It's yourself, there's Brian Nash from Frankie Goes to Hollywood, no less. We've got Philip Rambo. You've got a whole range of other family. How did you come up with the idea of setting this whole thing up? And let's face it, you know, you expect a few hundred. There could be thousands there.
Well, it was actually, I think it's the brainchild of my PR man, Manila PR, Tony McDonough.
Is that Tony McDonough, Sheffield Wednesday That's supporting it. Tony McDonough?
He's a Sheffield Wednesday fan, but we'll forgive him that. And it was his idea, and he asked me would I play, and I thought, do you know what, I've never been to that part of the world. So, and I know it has an ancient musical tradition, so I'm really looking forward to getting up there.
It's going to be awesome in so many ways. And as I say, we work quite a lot with Tony with the public relations side of things. And even though he is a Sheffield Wednesday fan, what the heck? It's all good stuff. Jason Whittaker, have you got anything you want to put to Ian Prowse? Possibly about the awesome documentary that was put together a year or so ago about the song.
I had missed the documentary, actually. But what I realised is that I actually knew if you work with Amsterdam because of the Elvis Costello connection. Mm. So consider me to be just a fanboying out at this end. That was because I knew the song as well. I didn't see the documentary, but I remember, you know, that the stuff about John Peel, etc., how much he'd liked it. So really, the kind of questions for me are all about, you know, the obvious ones are kind of like how you came to write a song. Everybody knows that, but why do you think it connected so strongly with people?
Oh, I don't know, because and it is strange because people, even from outside the Merseyside area, get really emotional, you know, when I sing a song.
Yes.
And I think there's just something in it. People know that it's straight up, you know, it's not trying to be clever. It's not trying to do anything else other than just be honest and passionate, you know. And it's about the good and the bad of the city of Liverpool. It's not just isn't Liverpool great sort of song. It's about the terrible things that have happened in Liverpool's history and the good things and the mundane things. So, and I think, you know, people respond to that. Liverpool's one of those cities, like sort of little New York. There's always something going on. It's punching above its weight in terms of its cultural significance, you know. So I thought it deserved a big song like that.
Yes, it is a big song.
It's going to be awesome, and as I say, the Bluebell Music Festival, starting and ending on the 18th of August 2018. Bluebell Music Festival, number one, of course. Totally free! I mean, this is a free music festival!
Can't complain, can you?
And launch it at 2 p.m. There's lots of entertainment for all the family. 2 p.m. through to 9 p.m. at the Bluebell Hotel in the Marketplace in Belford. It's going to be awesome. In a few moments' time, we'll also be connecting with John Reynolds, who I believe is also performing at the festival as well. So that's all great stuff from that point of view. Meanwhile, Ian, how is your beloved Tranmere progressing? Did you feel as though it's a success?
We've had a draw and a win. Mm-hmm. So far, in our first year back in the Football League, mm-hmm. after 3 years in the non-league wilderness, which mm-hmm. was thoroughly depressing, but now we're back. So I'm predicting the Premiership within 10 years.
Well, there we are, you see.
And no, I haven't had a drink.
Perhaps you can go up together with Lincoln City. You know, success in every sense of the word from that point of view. And allowing for the Elvis connection, would you prefer Oliver's Army? I Can't Stand Up for Falling Down. Pump It Up. I Don't Want to Go to Chelsea. Well, why would you if you're a Tranmere supporter? Tomorrow's Just Another Day. That's a joint one with Madness. Or indeed, New Lace Sleeves.
Or can I have I Don't Want to Go to Chelsea?
I thought you might, because, you know, that echoes in so many ways. Neither does Mr. Conte these days, but still, life continues. Has it been an okay telephonic link with your good self, Ian Prowse?
Yes.
And we will look forward to seeing you this Saturday, so you will return on an audio postcard.
Fantastic. I can't wait to get up there. A little cuddle, but there's no place here for the minuscule.
Everybody's got new orders. Be a nice girl, kiss the runners. Now the teacher is away. All the kids begin to play. Here comes school and dressed in white coat. Shake your mirror gently by the throat. One's named Gus, one's named Alfie. I don't want to go to Chelsea. Oh no, even though I've seen the movie, I don't want to check your pulse. I don't want nobody else. I don't want to go to Chelsea. Photographs and fancy tricks to get your pics at 66. And thinks of all the lips that it licks and all the girls that isn't going to fix. She gave a little flirt, gave us up a little cuddle. That there's no place here, bottom and a skirt waddle. Dabbles her furnace when she's last year's model. They call her the Dasher when she looks like Elsa. I don't want to go to Chelsea. Oh no, that's not me. Even though I see the movie, I don't want to check your balls. I don't want nobody else. I don't want to go to Chelsea.
Strange that was never actually used as the theme to the reality TV show Made in Chelsea, but then again, perhaps not. Elvis Costello, I don't want to go to Chelsea, even though we have a Made in Chelsea person coming along to the new Lincoln Theatre Royal in the next few weeks. The excitement is just phenomenal. In the studio we have Professor Jason Whittaker. Online we have a young lady who basically is just a phenomenon. I think was actually on your first ever programme with the Midweek Drive, Jason, where she was doing a whole manner of wonderful things and also came up with the wonderful rave in the current issue of SFX magazine, that's issue 304. My end of summer movie surprise is again about a little stuffed bear. I thought you were talking about me for a moment, Tara, but no, you know, somebody completely different really from that point of view. Christopher Robin, an absolute charmer, and the visual effects of the 100 Acre Woods is stellar.
Yes, unless you have an affinity for honey, I was talking about Winnie the Pooh. But it's so good to talk to you again.
There you go. Now, since we last spoke, of course, San Diego Comic Con has taken place. Richard Edwards was over there doing his stuff from that point of view. And it's the awesome range of TV material, specifically in the current edition, the mighty TV preview. There's more TV than ever before, so here's an expert guide to everything. It seems that between yourself and Richard, you've covered high-end of a couple of dozen shows, basically.
It was amazing. I mean, honestly, the amount of TV that's out there to watch and catch up with and start with is pretty overwhelming. But yeah, I think it's 29 pages of TV preview, which is almost our record, but not quite. So, you know, it was quite the feat. Quite the feat to get all of that done.
I did think you were actually sort of pushing it from that point of view. You seem to have actually gone for the superhero shows, which is good from that point of view. Obviously, reviewing on the joys of Arrow and Supergirl and so on. But, I mean, are there any kind of lovely sneak peeks which you think, Jason, who, I think, are you coming to terms with the Expanse, Jason? Because I know you were a big fan of Expanse.
How many series are there?
Two.
I've seen both of those.
I'm not sure whether there'll be a third. But
yeah. Which yeah. is a great disappointment to me. I love The Expanse.
Mm. Oh, no, it got picked up by Amazon. It's definitely coming back.
Right, yeah.
So there we are, Amazon and The Expanse. They haven't just got Manchester City's background stuff as well. They've got that as well. any particularly floats your boat, Tara, that you think, yeah, this is one we should all be watching out for?
You know, It's interesting because I was just at, right after San Diego, I went into 2 weeks of what is called Television Critics Association press tour, and I'm a member of that, and we do 2 weeks inside a hotel ballroom where every single day the network cable and broadcast all present what's coming for the next 6 months. And I have to say, genre-wise, there wasn't a whole lot that's brand new that had me super excited, but there are a lot of things coming in mid-season that I'm pretty excited about. There's History's doing a project with Aidan Gillen from Game of Thrones called Project Blue Book about UFO, all of those kind of real X-Files, and that one was really good. I like that as a pilot. They're doing a show on YouTube called Origin, which kind of has this kind of mixture of kind of Lost with like a kind of horror vibe to it. I don't know if anybody saw a show called Dark Matter a couple of years ago on Sci-Fi, but it's about a bunch of people that kind of wake up on this spaceship and don't know who they are to each other and why they've woken up when they're supposed to get to a destination. And this is a very similar kind of premise to it, but it's got a lot more of a horror vibe to it, and that's Paul W.S. Anderson directing that. But it has a Brit showrunner, so that's pretty exciting. I think, there's a couple things, but, mostly I think for me the fall is, kind of get back into some new seasons for shows that are existing. That's what the preview is, 14 years of Supernatural, that's still cooking and going, and certainly
14 years. That's almost as long as the last time you were delivering various other courses, Jason. 14 years.
It's amazing, isn't it? It's funny because I've covered San Diego Comic-Con for 16 years. This is my 16th year. And there has been 14 years. I always close out my con coverage in terms of the press stuff with Sundays and Supernatural. So it's going to be weird someday when that show does not exist. Mm. Because for me, it's my ringing bell of I'm free of all my San Diego stuff. But it is, when you think about it in terms of how long that show's been on the air, it's pretty amazing.
Those Winchester brothers, they said they never lost, but they have. They've done for so many sort of people, and they just keep on going. It's like the NCIS of horror fiction and various other things. They're relentless, really. People never talk about Stargate these days. It's all NCIS. A special mention for Anita Fusco-Bauman, who actually shared the video with the line, "My amazing cousin Tara Bennett is quoted in this new ad for Christopher Robin." Second quote in red with attribution, a new Disney classic. So I take it you'd actually sort of say that Christopher Robin is the place to actually go as far as nothing short of absolute magic and a new Disney classic.
I did. I loved it, honestly. I mean,
reminds me so much of staff meetings I've had at certain institutions. But no names.
Oh, it's been so rough lately, I think, in the real world, on your side of the pond and our side of the pond. So I greatly enjoyed kind of escaping to the gentility of those cute little stuffed animals, and I thought they did a beautiful job actually creating them to look like, what we would imagine them to look like as actual little stuffed animals, and I just thought it had a lot of really great hearts. So I was open to all of its charms and thoroughly happy with a wet eyes a couple times when I walked out of that movie. So, yes, I highly recommend it.
Well, there you go. And I thought Ant-Man and the Wasp featuring the Partridge Family and Come On, Get Happy was the height of it. But there we are. It's wonderful stuff. Jason, are you an A.A. Milne fan?
I am not an A.A. Milne fan. There's always been a dry eye in my house. My wife loves A.A. Milne and I never got it. I was looking through the TV series and actually I'm much more excited by The Man in the High Castle season 3.
Exactly.
Which is, yeah. Give me some good dystopian fiction any day.
Yes, they've gone beyond the work of Philip K. Dick and actually gone to some various thoughts he's put together for the third season. So they've opened that up a little bit more as far as that's concerned. Again, let's talk about The Incredibles, because I see that you've changed your image on Facebook once again, Tara, and you've gone head-to-head with Edna from The Incredibles. So was this a kind of fashion guidance guru you were going for here?
She's my spirit guide with all things capes, of course. So, if you can't wear a good cape, I mean, she's not a fan of them, but, if you can't wear a good cape and get criticized by Edna, then what's life all about?
Well, once again, Tara, you've got your finger on the cultural pulse, which is why we appreciate you coming on board for the whole set of things from that point of view. Jason, any other questions you want to put to Tara Bennett about life, the universe, or anything, really?
Well, actually, it was a chance to get an inside view. I was extremely excited in February that there was news that Ian Banks was going to be brought to the screen by Amazon, and then it's gone completely silent, and I just have a horrible suspicion it ain't going to happen. Has there been any news?
No, there really hasn't. But that doesn't mean that it's dead. Honestly, Amazon went through a big shift in who was the head of development.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So Jennifer is new, and she did present at TCA's. That wasn't a specific title that they talked about, but I would say at this point that nothing is dead. They're still, you know, developing things that were existing. They are still looking at their whole slate. They are just, you know, moving forward with some bigger titles because I think they want to get their Game of Thrones going and getting subscribers to come on because of that. But I promise you, I will follow up on that for you, and I will see if I can get some new dirt.
Thank you.
Well, Tara, we know that, a bit like the girl from Uncle when she was played by Stephanie Powers, we can entrust you with that task, and you'll just complete it. You'll knock it out of the park. You're like a one-woman Mission Impossible. Let's plug again the latest book that you put together with, of course, the wonderful Paul Terry, which is all to do with Marvel movies, which I think is now available to purchase as well.
Oh, no. One actually is out in May. It is the biggest thing that Paul Terry and I have ever written. We've been embedded with Marvel Studios for the last year. We basically have historically and journalistically charted out the entire 10 years of the studio from when it was kind of a place that would sell licenses to other to studios to make movies until they brought their movies in-house. And then every year from 2008 to this year, we track everything that was in development from the voices of everybody that participated. So we have 150 brand new interviews, have the complete access to the three big, the honchos at Marvel Studios with Kevin Feige, Victoria Alonso, and Luis Esposito, and we have basically tracked out their whole history about what they've done, how they've done it, and how they've turned into the biggest, literally, studio in Hollywood. And it's been a true honor. It'll be 500 pages, two volumes. It's cloth with a new artwork and gold leaf by Ryan Leinerding, who's the head of visual development at Marvel Studios. And so we are super excited. And then we announced that at San Diego Comic-Con that it would be out day and date with Avengers 4 Untitled, you know, which comes out next year in 2019. So we are super excited about that.
So there we are, you see. I was using my time machine to think it was already out there, but no, it clearly, what you say, we would put it on everybody's Christmas list. It's the book, a 10-year history people will have waited 11 years to receive. It's wonderful. Is there going to be a cameo by Stan the Man Lee? Because after all, he's been in most of the movies and indeed many of the TV series.
There is, in certain ways, you know, obviously Stan is going through some difficult times right now.
Indeed.
So, I'll let people wait until they see the book on how that's handled. So.
As Avatar, it's important to actually have a slight tease from that point of view. Jason, would you like to deliver those last two questions to Tara Bennett? No, it's okay. I thought, you know, it might have worked through the process. No. Tara, have you had an okay telephonic link with us on the program today?
Yes, you've been wonderful hosts. Thank you.
Well, and don't forget SFX magazine with the Predator on the front cover. Yes, Predator's back, scarier than ever, is available now with that awesome Tara Bennett's range of things. As I said to Richard regularly when we do the pizzas with Richard Edwards, somehow I feel an issue of SFX just isn't complete unless you actually got the letters TB to some of the articles from that point of view. I think it's just adds the whole sort of system. It's very true.
I so appreciate it, and Rich is the best. So I love running wing woman to his TV coverage this month. It is a corker of an issue. So definitely pick it up.
So I take it you'll be back with us in September.
Oh, I'd love to. Thank you.
Yay.
We'll sing in the sunshine. We'll laugh every day. Sunshine, then I'll be on my way. I will never love you, the cost of love's too dear. But though I'll never love you, I'll stay with you 1 year, and we can sing in the sunshine. Then I'll be on my way. I sing to you each morning. miss you every night. But darling, don't cling to me, I'll soon be out of sight. But we can sing in the sunshine, we laugh every day, we'll sing in the sunshine, then I'll be on my way. My daddy, he once told me, hey, don't you love you any man, just take what they may give you, and give but what you can. And you can sing in the sunshine, you laugh every day, you'll sing in the sunshine, then be on your way. And when a year has ended and I have gone away, you'll often speak about me, and this is what you'll say: we sang in the sunshine, you know we laughed every day, sunshine. Then she went on away.
Earlier in the program, we were speaking to the wonderful punk author, John Robb. Not to say he's a punk author, he's a punk, but he's delivering all sorts of things with the Lincoln Book Festival, of course. The chair of the Lincoln Book Festival. One of your old students, Jason. I would have thought it. One of your old sort of souls. Indeed. Who kind of developed in all sorts. It's Phil Hamlin-Williams. How are you, sir?
I'm very well, and how are you?
Excellent. Delighted to speak with your good self. Now, you are somewhere on a narrow boat. Is that true? Somewhere in the British Isles?
That is right. I am on a narrow boat heading towards the French, and from there into Lincoln.
Now, do you actually negotiate the locks and things all yourself, or do you have minions to do that for you?
Oh, no. We do it ourselves.
Sounds like a location report that's just waiting to be made.
Oh, absolutely.
This Friday at the Collection in 1 Danes Terrace in Lincoln, it's a Philip Hamlin-Williams talk and signing on ordnance equipping the British Army for the Great War, 7 p.m. It's awesome. And would you like to share with us, Phil, what exactly you're going to be doing when you'll be talking about the task of equipping the British Army in World War One?
Well, yes, and it's a lovely opportunity. It's an event put on by Endem Books, who are that wonderful independent bookshop up in the Bellgate. They put on author talks, I think, most months, and they invited me to do one, which was lovely. They've had my book and various advertising blurb in their window, and apparently they've been sending copies, which is, you know, very encouraging. Mm-hmm. But anyway, Friday, yes, I'm going to be focusing on two aspects of the way the army was equipped. I'm going to be looking quite specifically at the role of women, because without the astonishing efforts of many thousands of women, the army simply would have gone nowhere. And I'm going to be looking at the particular role that Lincoln took in this, Herculean task, really. So far as women are concerned, we'll be looking at the munitions factories. We'll be looking also, obviously, at the work they did at Foster's, the engineer in Lincoln, where the tank was invented. And that obviously played a significant part in swinging the war in the Allies' direction.
Now, as you know, Phil, I have already gone public with my thoughts on ordnance, and in fact, I posted my review on Amazon just for you. So good stuff from that point of view. I think it's a tremendous thing. It's a movie that's waiting to be made. Jason, any thoughts from yourself about this tremendous task, and also the extraordinary way in which Philip actually decided to pursue this line through his family treasures in an attic?
You've mentioned that in the past, Phil, actually. Could you say a little bit more about the treasures in the attic that actually led you?
That's right. It came from some scrapbooks my mother kept of my father's experience in the Second World War. She was then his PA, and I guess he probably told her, you know, put these in a scrapbook. And so there are about 7 scrapbooks, each about 4 or 5 inches thick, and they are full of newspaper cuttings and photographs and copies of speeches, Christmas cards. There's a wonderful Christmas card with a picture of a tank, dinner invitations, just, you know, to remind us that actually some aspects of ordinary life continue during war. So this is where I started, and in those albums I found the first story, which was how the army was mechanized in the Second World War. And I wrote the book War on Wheels.
Yes.
But having written that, it was very clear to me that many of the characters in that book had experienced the First World War as well, including my own father. And so I needed to look. And this time I didn't have the treasures in the attic. I had to do research in the good old-fashioned and time-honored way. But I found some treasures in, you know, in a sense, in other people's attics. Some people recorded almost in book form their experiences over the 4 years. With others, it was diaries. With one, it was a shoebox. But what a shoebox, with all sorts of wonderful mementos and photographs. And one thing it had in it, this man was stationed in Calais, and it had his pass. And on the front of the pass, you know, it said pass. And on the back, it had a long list of places he couldn't go, which is an absolute gem.
As I said when we were speaking about it before, Phil, the thing that strikes me is just how little we've actually learnt from history. You can look at a whole range of things happening now in terms of organisation or lack of organisation, bureaucracy and so on, that sometimes you think, are we ever going to sort of get in there 100 years ago? Still continuing.
And it's fascinating, you know, after you sort of pulled that strand out of the book, I've been pondering, and it is astonishing why people just don't learn, or if they do learn, they forget so quickly. You know, if I look at over a bit of a time scale, in 1914, there was absolutely no way we were equipped to do anything remotely like winning a war. The massive efforts of the ordinary men and women, but led, I have to say, by Lloyd George as Minister of Munitions, and it did swing that round. So by 1918, September, I would say, 1918, we were fit for purpose and could go ahead and finish the job. But then all of that somehow was forgotten, because in 1939, in a sense, to be honest, we got it worse. The you know, the British Expeditionary Force crossed over to France in September 39, and nothing much happened until May. And then in June, of course, it was evacuated at Dunkirk, having left behind all its equipment. So that lesson wasn't learned very well. By D-Day, I think we were spot on. I think we were supremely well equipped. And, you know, everything had been done to enable that successful evasion to take place. But then I honestly think late 40s and into the 50s and into the more recent conflicts, you know, problems that could have been avoided by lessons learnt have just been stepped into time and again.
The talk is Ordnance, Equipping the British Army for the Great War. It's on Friday the 17th of August. That's this Friday at 7 p.m. Tickets an astonishingly low £4 from Linden Books. You can also, I think, probably get them online, but go to Linden Books and sort of thing through. Stokes Cafe will be providing a bar for pre-event drinks. It's at the Collection, 1 Danes Terrace, of course, in Lincoln. It's going to be tremendous. Philip Hamden Williams, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today?
I have thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you.
Are you back with us again? Well, in fact, I think 2 weeks from now you're actually going to be in the studio in the huge build-up to the awesome, the wonderful, revolutionary Lincoln Book Festival, Lincoln Literary Festival.
I greatly look forward to it.
And if I asked you for Katie Grimerson, who's listening over in Birmingham, would you recommend Nirvana Smells Like Teen Spirit or Nirvana and Lithium? You're probably going to say, I've never heard of either of them.
Probably.
I thought you might. It's okay. Well, I mean, Jason, which lithium. One? You're going to go for Lithium?
Oh, yes.
Well, nice choice.
Now, I wonder, can I ask Jason a question?
Of course.
Was he there at the unveiling?
He was in a I was there, and William Blake was in the tree above the plane tree above our heads.
You mean to say, Philip, you weren't listening to the first part of the programme? I mean, honestly, you know, for goodness sakes, I mean, what else is there to do when you're on a boat?
I was one of the speakers of the unveiling of the grave.
Because I saw that one of the lesser speakers didn't make it, Mr. Pullman.
Yes.
So I'm very glad you did.
Yes.
Well, and so is the world. That's the important thing.
Still, well, absolutely.
It gives you something to listen to on the podcast, which is splendid.
I look forward to it. And one day I'll tell you what I was doing in the last couple of hours.
We will hold fire on that one, Philip. We will hold fire.
I'm so happy because today. That's okay, 'cause so are you. Book of Mirrors, Sunday morning is every day for all I care. And I'm not scared by my candles in our days, 'cause I found God. Yeah, I'm to blame for all I've heard. I'm not sure. I'm so excited. I can't wait to meet you there. I don't care. I'm so horny. That's okay. My will is good. I like it, I'm not gonna crack. I miss.
were talking earlier about the awesome Bluebella Festival, and one of the names that will be performing there is John Reynolds, singer-songwriter from Manchester, England. He's back with us now. John, how are you, sir?
All right, Alex, I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Very good indeed. And we're about to listen to Days of New York, your latest single, a song about friendship and living your dreams. So that's great stuff there to follow up High and Low, which High and Dry, I should say, which actually reached number 2 on the iTunes singer-songrighter charts. So doubtless this is going to go straight to number 1, and we would not be at all surprised, which is great stuff.
Thanks very much. Appreciate the support.
Well, it's all good. And John, I'm not sure whether I've asked you this, but City or United?
United, of course.
Okay. It's okay, Jason. I mean, I concur. I can be brave now, because at the end of the day, they wouldn't have actually had a stadium to actually occupy if they hadn't visited Main Road during the war. So that's by the bias.
I'm going to pretend I know what you're talking about.
It's okay. There's an Amazon series, which is going to be awesome, that launches actually on the 17th of August. Particularly the line I like, which is, I don't care if you hate me, hate me, hate me, as long as you perform well on the pitch. That's very good. Interesting motivating thing there. Anyway, John, let's not talk association football. Let's move on to the joy of Days of New York. And what are you looking forward to at the Bluebella Festival, the first ever Bluebella Festival?
Yeah, that's what's exciting. I mean, first of all, I've not played in the area before, so that's like quite a big thing for me, to be honest, because, you know, it's sort of expanding the audience and getting myself out there to play to new crowds. And from what I can gather from hearing about the event and stuff, it's going to be pretty spectacular. So, yeah, really excited, really looking forward to it.
It is indeed. Jason, what do you think? Should we actually go straight into Days of New York by John Reynolds and then come back to John afterwards?
Yeah, let's listen to it, and then because I'm looking forward to hearing this.
John, introduce yourself, please.
So, yeah, so this is my latest single, available on all formats, iTunes, etc. This is Days of New York. Enjoy.
Bludgeoning in pain, and I can't quite remember, where did we end up last night? Starting midtown, that's all I can say, with an East Village vibe in our sights. Slung across small dunes bar, singing songs from way back home. Living out this American dream tonight. Whoa, whoa. How I recall and love those days in New York. As time stood still, we knew what we were living for. And shared a few whiskeys, told tales of days gone by. Tears of laughter fell from the sky, this world in the palm of our hands. Four coin tricks and beer mat flips, such innocence ran through the night. All of the while, just looking across at
John Reynolds, Days of New York. Professor Jason Whittaker, what did you make of it?
That was great. That was. I'm really glad that you introduced me to this, Alex.
That's it. John, is that autobiographical? Were you actually in New York, or did you just sort of think, well, it sounded so much better than Days of, I don't know, Darlington?
Yeah, no, it's definitely autobiographical. Keeping it short and sweet. Basically, a friend of mine, we used to go out there to New York quite a bit. He fell in love with somebody, ended up emigrating out there, got me a few gigs. And, yeah, it's just the tale of that whole journey, which I've put on my Facebook page and stuff. So if people want to read the real story, feel free to click on and get the full details, so to speak.
Splendid. This is marvellous stuff, and we will continue ever onwards from that point of view when we see you at the Blue Bella Festival. When are you on, actually?
I'm on at 4 p.m. on Saturday.
Excellent.
So, yeah, going to do mainly originals and maybe one or two covers as well, just to, you know, so people can hear some music that they actually know. Obviously, when you're a new artist, it's a bit difficult at first, isn't it, when people
How long have you been playing for, then?
Me? A long time, getting on for 30 years, pretty much. Yeah. So just, you know, the usual sort of stuff, cover gigs and what have you, and then I've been lucky enough to play a few gigs around the world, so yeah. Just keep cracking on, don't you? If it's what you love, you just do it.
Yes.
Well, John, we look forward to connecting with you on Saturday. Has the telephone conversation with you today been okay?
It's been awesome, yeah. Thanks very much. I appreciate all the support. I'm looking forward to seeing you Saturday.
And you do know that Tony McDonough is a Sheffield Wednesday fan, which is even worse than a City fan, really. Oh, sorry, Tony. It's just that.
I'm not going to get into that one.
No, best not to. I mean, after all, I mean, you've got a wonderful, happy manager in charge these days. So, I mean, he's always looking at the bright side of life.
Yeah, he's proper happy, isn't he? He'll be happy when we win the league, so that'll be all right.
Whoa, John Reynolds, take care. See you soon. Take care now.
All right, see you Saturday. Cheers. Take care.
It only takes hearing Shelley Tackett once to understand why she is one of Nashville's most celebrated emerging artists. And she's on the programme now, a little bit later than we'd originally anticipated. But Shelley Tackett, welcome to the programme. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks so much for having me.
Delighted to connect with your good self. Now, you're not bitter, are you? Because, I mean, bitter girl, we'd hate to think that was autobiographical.
You know, I have my moments. And to some extent, I wrote this song to myself to remind myself there's so much good in the world and to not stay in a bitter place.
Hey, do you know, that could be advice for the politicians of the world, whatever your political viewpoint. But let's not go there, because otherwise it could open up a whole range of things.
There you go.
Anyway, moving on. In the studio, we've got the fabulous Professor Jason Whittaker. Jason, first time you've heard Shelley Tackett?
It is indeed. And that was wonderful. As I say, you know, it's absolutely fantastic to see where you are, an up-and-coming star. Mm. And I've quickly added you to my Spotify playlist, so that's going to carry on later.
Because you don't buy albums, do you? You just actually go for the Spotify thing, as you say. I do
buy albums, but they have to be old 78s that involve renditions of William Blake.
Oh, yeah. Vinyl Man.
Not even vinyl, it's shellac. Yeah.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
Shelley's blend of lyrical intensity and melodic craftsmanship have earned her recognition and respect in a town where being a standout is a rare achievement. I can't believe Tessa Snart isn't with us to actually say this. This is her sound and contribution. She'd be exactly. Yeah. You know, it's amazing. Still, that's part and parcel of the whole thing. Shelley, are you looking forward to coming across to the UK later in the year?
I cannot wait.
How long will you be in the UK for?
I was over there about 8 years ago. On a small tour with a small record label I was on, and I had the time of my life, so I can't wait to come back.
Well, the good news is Lauren Wood has just arrived, and Lauren knows her music because she works for Soundlinks in Lincolnshire, and she's got a first-class honours degree. She's just awesome in many ways. Lauren, did you bring your tambourine?
I have, yes.
Marvellous. I know, Jason, you might well look askance, but bringing out the tambourine and the maraca is part and parcel of Lauren's kind of duties these days, which is awesome stuff from that point of view. Whilst Lauren's getting herself psyched up for this, I feel we should actually have another Shelley Tackett number. Shelley, would you like to introduce Ohio to us? Because I suspect this is nothing to do with Olivia Newton-John singing about dying by the banks of the Ohio.
You know, I did a cover of the Neil Young song, and yep. I don't typically do covers, mm-hmm. but it felt appropriate for this album, and I also happen to be a graduate of the university that the song, the incident, occurred at, Kent State University, and so it seemed tied to me, it seemed tied to the theme of this album, and so I felt like, for once, I should do a cover song, and this is that.
Soldiers and Nixons come, we're finally on our own. This summer I hear the drum for dead in Ohio. Gotta get down to it, soldiers are cutting us down. Should have been done long ago. What if you
as one of the more tragic elements of the Vietnam War, of course, the Kent State Massacre, that was Ohio by Charlie Tackett. What did you make of that, Jason?
I thought that was absolutely fantastic, actually. Really got to me. That was an incredible piece of music.
And Lauren?
Yeah, maybe feel energised.
Energised?
Yeah, I felt energised.
Interesting.
Yeah. Your latest album, Buckeye, was given a 4 out of 5 star rating. I believe it should be 5 out of 5, surely. On the March 2018 edition of the UK's Country Music People, and Think Country UK said, if this amazing singer-songwriter hits your town, go! Triple exclamation mark. It's quite right too. I can't even say enough about her album Buckeye. Brilliant. She is a Merlefest Chris Austin Songwriting Contest winner, Kerrville Folk Festival New Folk winner, Independent Acoustic Music Award finalist. You've got it all, basically. This Shelley, it's conquering the world. So when you're making way to the UK between the 8th and the 15th of October, are the details on your website, and are you coming anywhere near the lovely place of Lincoln, England, as opposed to Lincoln, Nebraska?
Well, you know, I'm terrible at geography once I get outside of the United States, so I'm not entirely sure how close to Lincoln I'm getting. I know we're mostly in the south. We're in Cornwall and Exeter. We have a High Wycombe date near London. We have a Brighton date and then another London date. But I'm coming back in March, so maybe I'll get closer to Lincoln then.
Well, I think, I mean, it took various folks, actually, because, I mean, Lincoln's 120 miles north of London, thereabouts. Actually, less than that. Uh-huh. It's still ballpark figure about that sort of time. We haven't measured it recently. It could change in all sorts of ways. But the key thing is access that, access all manner of other details. Jason, any final thoughts for Shelley that you... Sorry, it's seeing Chelsea. I don't want to go to Chelsea. No, Shelley, C-H-E-L-E-Y.
I did want to share, actually, sorry, although this is hijacking the Ohio title, but there's a piece of poetry by William Blake called The Men of Thames, and it ends, though born on the cheating banks of Thames, though his waters bathe my infant limbs, the Ohio shall wash his stains from me. I was born a slave, but I go to be free.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I've always loved that poem.
Yeah,
it clearly needs to have a song written about it, Shelley. And you're
just
the person
a small hint
to actually do it.
You'd
exactly.
do a great song.
Yeah, it will work. Up next, Phil Herdwood. Hopefully, Phil Leonis will connect from the States as well. But who would have thought we'd actually go from that to a whole new world of Americana? I'll save the actual artist until we've actually heard his performance. But meanwhile, Shelley, two final questions for you. Have you had a lovely telephonic link with us? Has it been okay for yourself? Has it been good, even though we kept you waiting for 17 English minutes?
I had a great time, y'all.
So I take it we can connect with you again in the very near future?
I would love that, yes. Yeah, thank you.
Oh, what did Delaware, boy, what did Delaware? What did Delaware? Wore a brand new jersey, she wore a brand new jersey, she wore a brand new jersey. Oh, why did California, why did California, why did California, was she all alone? She called to say how are you, she called to say how are you, she called to say how are you, that's why she did phone. Uno, two, Mississippi boy, what did Mississippi, what did Mississippi boy, through her pretty lips? She sipped the Minnesota, she sipped the Minnesota, she sipped the Minnesota, that's what she did sip. Oh, where has Oregon, boy, where has Oregon? If you want Alaska, Alaska, where she's gone? She went to pay her taxes, she went to pay her taxes, she went to pay her taxes, that's where she has gone. Ein, zwei, drei, vier. Oh, how did Wisconsin, boy, she stole a new brass key. Too bad that Arkansas, boy, and so did Tennessee. It made poor Florida die, boy, it made poor Florida die. You see, she died in misery, boy, she died in misery. Oh, what did Delaware, boy, what did Delaware? What did Delaware, boy, what did Delaware?
And off he goes in his own PC way. Perry Como, Delaware. Were you expecting that, Philip Herdwood?
No, I wasn't. I wasn't expecting to hear cheese in such a large scale coming from your radio show.
Large scale cheese.
I mean, that was as cheesy. That was a whole fromagerie, that was. I mean, that was... Perry Como was not known for his... delicacy, shall we say. It was all extremely cheesy American stuff. But nothing wrong with that.
Exactly. Lauren, have you encountered Perry Como at all?
I haven't,
really. No. Probably something to look out for on the Spotify lists and various other bits and pieces. Or maybe
yes.
Not.
And when you hear it, you can smash your phone then. Or something.
There we are. We may be joined by Phil Lernis if he dials up via Skype. If not, well, he won't. And that's part and parcel of the whole system. But we've been talking about the Blake effect. And we started off the programme, of course, Jason, by talking about how you were present at a very important unveiling a few days ago of a tombstone.
Indeed. So, So Blake was buried in Bunhill Fields in London 191 years ago. And nobody actually knew where he was buried. Fairly typical of the time. He's actually, the plot where he's buried actually houses eight people, because that was the standard thing. You just buried one corpse on top of the other to fill up the space. So
it's kind of like multi-packing sort of way.
Absolutely. You know, and stack them high.
Sell them cheap. Or perhaps not, if Burke and Hare weren't around.
That's tasteless, Alexia.
Shame on you.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you talk about taste. I mean, surely Phil Lernis, you're not going to say that was a tasteless line, would you? By any chance? Oh, my word, he sounds as though he's actually sort of... He's got all sorts of things there.
I'm experiencing some technical difficulties. Sorry, Alex. But I had to immediately rush to the defense of Perry Como and just say, how dare you, to each of you. I was a sophomore or a junior. I was a junior in university, end of the 80s. My roommate and I were comparing notes on music, and suddenly the name Perry Como came up. And by the end of the conversation, we were like drug addicts walking the streets of Westwood, jonesing for a fix, went to record stores and purchased every Perry Como compact disc we could get our hands on.
Was this some sort of an ironic gesture, you know, in Hollywood, or was this meaningful and heartfelt?
Yes. Yes, I
we need to know. We have listeners here who are gagging to know.
Look, my heart is my least vulnerable spot, and I don't know where it ends and my irony begins.
That's a tricky one. That is a tricky one for sure.
But either way, I deeply enjoy it. Can't it be a yes and? The truth is, some of those tunes, Magic Moments, I mean...
I know the one very well. I'll tell you what, though, Phil Lernis. I'll tell you what. I've got an album here. Now, you can't call me a recidivist, or you can't call me anything, really. You can call me anything you like, as long as it's not too early in the morning. But I've got an album called Music to Watch Girls By. It's a double,
yes!
Double album.
Oh, of course you do.
It's all right, Lauren. Don't worry. It's politically correct.
I have played it, and it's a great album. There's no question. It's full of cheese. It's got every variety of cheese you can imagine, but it's wonderful.
What goes better with cheese than cheese?
Crackers.
More cheese, please.
You have that album because you have two ears and a heart. So how could you not have that album?
This is what it comes down to, yeah.
But also, and in all seriousness, Perry Como, quite a voice, very famous in this country for his Christmas specials. There was a wonderful parody on Second City Television, a wonderful parody called Perry Como Barely Alive, because it made fun of how relaxed he always was, and he's just laying down on stage through the whole special. But I would say this, Do You Hear What I Hear is one of the most emotional Christmas standards, and no one... did a better rendition. No one, not Bing Crosby, no one, than Perry Como. So I will stake my reputation on that.
So you see,
well,
Jason.
Well, fair play, and you've stood up for him in a wonderful way. I mean, there's no question. Perry Como informs, in a slightly different way to Frank Sinatra and some of the other crooners like Crosby and all these sorts of people.
Yeah.
You know, and the Rat Pack and all these guys. But, you know, Perry Como defined a kind of post-Eisenhower America that was, you know, full of largesse, and everybody had a good job, and everybody had nice appliances in their kitchen, and life was good, you know, everybody had crew cuts. You know, it was, not the women, of course, but, you know, it was a good time to be alive in America.
Unless, of course, you were a non-white person. But let's not go there.
That's another issue.
When we say make America great again, it's the sweater-wearing Perry Como that I choose to think of when I hear that phrase, rather than the hood-wearing social clubs.
Well, that's it, exactly. Yeah.
You know,
so Jason, yeah. You can now see how we've moved from the Blake effect to the fantasy music paradigm.
Hey, in a way which is... by the way, let's stick to music. How about that rendition of Ohio? And by the way, you know, my beloved Paul Weller did a terrific live recording of Ohio that basically, if you'd ever wondered what it would sound like if the Small Faces did a recording of Ohio, that would be his version, and it was spectacular. And
how funny, huh?
I grew up with one of my friends growing up. His father had been a chemistry professor at Kent State during the riots and in an era before social media and before 24-hour news. And he missed the whole thing because he was in his classroom staying in, giving extra credit help to some of his students who were struggling. And they missed the entire thing, just locked in a chemistry room. Can you imagine something like that happening today? I mean, unbelievable.
It'd be all over. Everybody'd be looking at their phones, wouldn't they, and checking what's happening on Twitter. Yeah.
Let's just hold fire there for a moment. Lauren, if I can bring you in a moment, because one of the things you said when we did the first ever New Lincoln Theatre Royal show last week was that it was something which, now being based in Lincoln, now being a graduate and so on, you wanted to actually sort of get your entertainment from more than just your mobile phone.
Yeah.
There we are.
I did grow up with... just being consuming entertainment on devices, so
and not seeing the live
nature to just do that instead of sourcing anything else.
And seeing the live theatrical performance, and of course you're seeing Blake at the New Lincoln Theatre Royal in how many days?
I think maybe about 7 or 8.
7 or 8 days. And Lauren can say that she will have seen the people that you sat next to.
Absolutely.
At the unveiling of the Blake tombstone.
Indeed. And all I can say is that
where do you stand then? Where do we stand then with holograms, with having a sort of resurrected stars from the past?
Why wasn't William Blake there himself as a hologram?
William Blake didn't die. Or rather, he wrote in a visitor's book of a friend in 1826, William Blake, who delights in the pleasure of good company, was born in 1757 and has died many times since.
Expand on that.
So this was simply his kind of introduction is that, you know, William Blake was constantly being reborn again, so he never really died.
Or else he was a stand-up comic who had a very poor act.
In public opinion, do you mean?
No. He meant kind of, you know, that Blake was incredibly Christian in his own way, so he was always being born again.
Yeah.
There we are.
I see what you mean. I see what you mean. He was a bit of a devil, though, wasn't he? I was down in a little seaside town. I've forgotten where it was now. Somewhere between Sussex.
Yeah, but he lived in Felpham for a while, near Bognor Regis.
That's it. And there was it. I was there, and there was a plaque. And apparently, there was a pub I just happened to go into to get a coffee or something. And there was a pub, and apparently, he had, shall we say, a little contretemps with a soldier.
Yes, he was arrested. He was arrested and tried for treason.
He was indeed, because he was berating a soldier in the doorway of this pub. And I stood in that doorway and thought, good God, this is resonant. This is, you know, William Blake, the most important. Possibly one of the most important, almost post-metaphysical poets there was, you know, who left his mark on our national consciousness in so many ways. And there he was, having a scuffle with a squaddy in the doorway of this pub.
It was the very pub in the very same year. So he was arrested for treason at Chichester Crown Court. And it's the same year that he wrote And Did Those Feet, which of course then becomes Jerusalem. So
the most
patriotic hymn was written by a guy who actually was nearly kicked out of the country.
I wonder were the two in any way linked, those two
so
slightly. But he lived in Feltham, didn't he, for a while?
He lived in Feltham for 3 years.
And there's a very nice little house, actually. I've seen it. I was there about six or eight months ago.
Yeah, the Blake Trust owns it now.
And the podcast, Blake: The Man and the Music.
Absolutely.
Are you okay there, Phil? Lewis? Have you fallen off the as the mouse fallen down? Is it a case you got bored? I mean, I don't know. Is it wedding planning again?
Please, William Blake. William Blake will actually figure prominently, I have no doubt. This sounds like a joke, and it's not a joke. I'll be happy to tell a joke later so you can tell the difference. But William Blake will figure prominently in Lily and my wedding in February.
In what way?
One of the great Blake scholars, a wonderful philosopher and painter and writer, is performing the ceremony.
Ah, well, how absolutely wonderful. This is very cyclical, isn't it? It's gone round in a really weird way. So you're getting married in the autumn, or you know,
February on President's Day, and I actually have my invitation to the wedding on my office desk.
Day before President's Day.
Have a very happy time, and I hope we speak before that. But my goodness me, congratulations. Well done.
Well, Phil Leonis and Lily Hollyman, it's the equivalent of the heart-to-heart of the entertainment world, really. I think they see me as either Freeway or the Butler Max. But you know, tragically, I might be teaching at that time, so I don't know.
So you know, I mean, there will be a gift. There will be a special prize for whoever travels the furthest to attend the wedding.
There you go, Alexius. Book that ticket now. Get a discount.
I'm never going to be allowed down to the country.
They might not let you back, Alexius.
Thank you, Philip. back to American Philip, please. What were you saying?
There will be no shortage of interview possibilities for you that weekend as well. I mean, you know, it is a Siren FM. I don't know how taxes work there, but if you were American, it would be a wonderful write-off the entire trip because you'd be able to do so many interviews for Siren FM.
Yeah, well, let's... We've got my line manager in the studio, so
I'm not going to sign up his expenses.
Alexius will have about half a dozen assistants who will help to volunteer.
There we are. It's going to be wonderful, though. Whatever. In fact, I've already started dealing with
who's performing the ceremony.
Well, I had thought it was going to be Alex, but I guess I need to come up with a. The artist's name, the philosopher, the writer is Lee McCloskey, who is most famous still for having been one of the stars of the original TV series Dallas. But he's a wonderful man. He runs Olindar, a foundation for emerging renaissance, and he did a tremendous book called Tarot Revisioned, where he, as an artist, was so offended by how people use the tarot. Yeah. You know, and he would always say that the cards, it wasn't supposed to be like playing poker. You know, you get a full house and three people die. It wasn't supposed to be like that, telling the future. It was supposed to be that when you saw these images, when you pulled a card, you understood the mythological ramifications of the energetic that you might be best advised to explore, to form a new relationship with. But what he realized was that these symbols, they had lost resonance. We'd lost our symbolic literacy. So he said it would be really valuable to revision the tarot symbols so that they spoke directly to a contemporary audience, that they would know the deeper ramifications of these things, that the meaning would be unlocked in their DNA. So people heard his criticism and said, okay, smart guy, why don't you do this? Why don't you redraw the tarot? And he thought, this will be a fun project for 6 months. 20 years later, he finished the project. And one of the best stories, and I think it's shared in my documentary, The Truth is Out There, but he was working on the world archetype. And what he ended up painting was, because these were all very elaborate paintings originally, he painted these twin towers representing the binary way we view the world. And it was a painting about how we needed to tear down these twin towers in order to release the inner perceptions. And put simply, but what was staggering was this painting of these twin towers was dated 9/11 1986. So 15 years to the day before the Twin Towers did in fact come down.
Good heavens, that's a bit chilling, isn't it?
Lee McCloskey has contributed numerous essays on topics ranging from William Blake and the heroic imagination, the archetypal tarot and the Kabbalah, to Jacob Boehm and theosophical thought. Another book there, Jason.
And how do we get him to do our wedding? Because, quite frankly, Lily Holloman is a big deal.
I think it's a combination factor. That's the important thing. Anyway, life continues. Phil Leonis.
How thrilling, yeah. My goodness.
Phil Leonis, have you got any other questions, observations, comments that you'd like to raise with the team? Lauren, of course, Professor Jason Whittaker, or indeed Phil Herdwood.
I mean, it's such an august group here.
well, you're quite right. It's the month for us, really.
I don't know. I mean, I have only been listening for the last, you know, around 10 o'clock. What was everybody's highlight of the first hour of the program?
Jason, as we were doing a tabulando from that point of view.
One of my highlights was finding out if Ian M. Banks is going to be turned into a TV series. So yes. I've got to follow up on that.
Yeah. Yes. Well, if anybody can deliver, it'll be Tara Benish, the SFX USA editor, which is very important. Ian Prowse, of course, William Coles, Phil Hamlin-Williams, John Robb and Anna Lewis were also contributing to that. It makes the podcast just that little bit more worthwhile from that point of view. Philip Herdwood, because it's difficult to get Philip onto a telephone, let alone listen to the programme. I mean, no one knows what that point of view is, etc. I presume you didn't manage to catch any of the early production?
Who are you talking to?
Well, the reason I said Phil Herdwood is because I thought it would be yourself.
I should have given me a clue, shouldn't I, really?
No, it's okay. Lauren, it's like being back in one of my seminars
again. I was in a bit of a trance then because I thought you were asking Phil Leonis.
Well, of course.
I thought, I won't say anything. I'll just let them have a chat amongst themselves.
you actually said Philip, which let me know that it wasn't me, because unless you're my mother and you're angry with me, you're not going to call me Philip. So
there is. Well, then, Alexis only calls me Philip. Only calls me Philip when he's annoyed at me or when he wants something.
Oh well, fair enough.
Right, when you come and do another broadcast.
So he always calls you Philip then.
Does he?
Don't worry.
Well, he always wants something.
Do not go there.
He's always on the elbow. Always on the old. There's a word for it in Cockney, which I won't repeat. No, but he's always on the old qui vive, isn't he? Really, as they say.
Lauren, would you like to bring out your tambourine, please? Because I think the movie says
this is not
a euphemism, but it's time that we can bring out the tambourine. Because
bring
I
out the tambourine and the Salvation Army band, the whole Salvation Army band.
Now, the reason that you've come equipped with a tambourine is partly to do with your work with Soundlinks. And would you express why that is the case? Because it could be a last-minute addition to the musical accompaniment needed for Phil Leonis's wedding to Lily Holloman in February.
I think it possibly could be.
Mm-hmm.
Well, to be honest, you were quite enthusiastic about
the tambourine.
Yeah, very enthusiastic. Mm-hmm. Because why not make music when you can?
Why not make music? Because you got the tambourine, and I think you've also got one of the maracas.
I've got a maraca.
Jason, would you like to take the maraca from that perspective?
I shall take the maracas.
And Phil, would you like to select a particular song or tune which we will attempt to do with accompaniment? This will be Phil Leonis from the maracas and the tambourine, please.
Shall I hum as well?
Yes, Phil, I think that'll be good. That'll be good. All right, so Mr. Leonis, what is your choice?
I mean, the one that always comes to mind is Hey Jude.
Nice. Do you think we could do that? Okay, so a little bit of... Now, the final chorus.
You're
posing
this, Alex.
I'll lead. We'll do the final chorus, because actually, very important thing, because Philip Herdwood once got a lift from George Harrison. The connection there.
I did, yeah. I'm not something you put on a shoe. No, it wasn't one of those kinds of lifts. It was actually a proper lift, a proper transportation kind of.
Were you hitchhiking?
I was hitchhiking, and it was one of these situations where there were strikes all over the place. There were no trains, no nothing, no buses, no coaches, and I had to travel from London down to the south coast of England. It's about 65-70 miles, and I was told it was 3 in the morning, and I was told I had to hitch. So I got a cab. to the nearest point where this road began, where I could start hitching, because I didn't. And I had a list of different towns I had to go through written down on a piece of paper. And I was there at Hammersmith Bridge with my thumb out, and a car, a big black Mercedes with tinted windows, suddenly slid to a halt by the traffic lights. And this face leaned out, and it was a moustachioed guy wearing a pink sort of desert suit with a floppy pink hat on. And he said, "Where are you going?" And I said, "Good God, it's John Lennon." And he said, "No, it's George Harrison, actually." So, no, anyway, that was a bad accent. Anyway, so and I said, "Well, I'm heading down to Portsmouth." I said, "All right, George, you want to hop in?" So anyway, so I got in, and we drove for about 40 miles or something, and we shot the breeze, and we had a few laughs. And he was just an extraordinarily nice man. I got him to sign an autograph for me, and he was just gentle and lovely. And I said something about, he said, "What's your favourite Beatles number song?" And I asked him, I told him, and I can't even remember what it was now, and he said, "You haven't got very good taste, have you?" I thought that was my little takeaway from that one. But yeah, but he was a lovely guy, lovely guy.
And to guide you through that, as we featured George's sister on the programme as well, from that point of view, we'll just have a little accompaniment here with respect to Hey Jude with Jason Whittaker on
the Americans. Oh, I want to hear this, yes.
And indeed, Lauren on the wonderful tambourine. Take it away, please.
Don't be afraid.
Chills, chills, keep it going, fantastic. Are you ready to join in, Phil Leonis, in Los Angeles? Feel free to chirp in Little London, please, Phil Herdwood.
I'm loving every minute of it. I'm loving every minute of it.
You're not taking a bloody photo.
You can't improve on this, can you?
I shall never insult community theatre again.
And if that doesn't make number one by the Christmas festivities, I don't know what
this will. Is probably one of the most surreal moments I've had on your show.
I like to ratchet them up every so often. Well done, Lauren. Well done, Jason.
Well done, I love
well done indeed.
I shall treasure the recording of this show forever, I think.
Well done, the Beatles.
I shall want it played at my funeral, I think.
But it's all there. So, Phil Leonis, would you like to ask Professor Jason Whittaker, Lauren Wood, and Phil Herdwood those last two questions, as you do so effortlessly and with style, before you join us again at midnight Los Angeles time tomorrow morning, when we can have the weather for Lincoln from both Gibraltar and indeed Los Angeles?
Well, I trust I don't have to ask six questions. I trust that we're looking for a consensus.
I think so.
Among the panel. So, panel, have you enjoyed your appearance on the Midweek
Don't forget, guys, an a cappella answer if we can. Yes, indeed.
Well said, Phil.
Absolutely. That came from nowhere.
Did you like it?
Ditto.
Let's do it again, and we'll all say yes, indeed. We'll do it a cappella. Can we do that?
I think it's a cappella. What the heck?
Yes, indeed. There you go.
That's another jingle.
And can we look forward to your musical stylings a future edition of the Midweek Draft?
Absolutely. This is what radio was made for.
There we have it. Lauren, you kept very quiet, so I realised it's a bit of a shock, but never mind.
Shock, I expect, yes.
Exactly.
Bewilderment.
Well, I'll be off to do a Stone Tapes with wonderful Sam Stone, who will actually be performing as well at the bookstore that we were speaking about with Phil Hanley Williams in September. So a whole heap of good things there. David J. Howe's with us. We've also got George. I was going to say George Mason. That's not George Mann. George
it's
Mann.
George Harrison.
No, it's George Mann. Could have been, but I think it's George Mann. So lots of stuff there. The theme is Jaws. The theme is Sharks. Sharknado. All sorts of other bits and pieces. Thanks to Anna Lewis, William Coles, Ian Prowse, Tara Bennett, Phil Hamlin Williams, John Robb, John Reynolds, Philip Hardwood, Philip Leonis, and you, dear listener, keep on keeping on. Can we all now say, in whichever style you want,
goodbye.
One, two, three.
Goodbye. Goodbye.